generosity is good, lying is bad, treason is bad, treachery is bad. You know, these are the things many people, they had no idea of, for example, backbiting. Backbiting is so bad, you know. The religion of Islam and the Prophet of Islam said that backbiting is absolutely forbidden. It's just like eating someone's flesh, your brother's flesh. So everyone is aware that to lie is wrong. And this is the intellect, the human intellect, you know, also says. The prophets came to emphasize the difference between right and wrong. And also to tell that this is right and this is wrong. To just remind them of what is right and what's wrong. And the prophets also teach us things which we were not aware of. So there are some details which the human intellect cannot explore, cannot identify, cannot discern. The Quran says in chapter 91, verse 7, "And the soul and him who perfected it, then he inspired it to understand what is right and wrong for it. فَأَلْهَمَهَا فُجُورَهَا وَتَقْوَاهَا وَنَفْسِ وَمَا سَوَاهَا وَنَفْسِ وَمَا سَوَاهَا فَأَلْهَمَهَا فُجُورَهَا وَتَقْوَاهَا." It means that God inspired man and the human soul to understand what's right and what's wrong. Let's have a break. We will be back.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes. And we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand there crying. We thought we'd paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Man's success and man's prosperity, man's, you know, salvation depends on the soul. And his discrimination of good from bad is not enough. He should act on the knowledge he has been given by Almighty Allah. Man will never be satisfied by anything except by the remembrance of Allah. And by drawing closer to him. الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَتَطْمَئِنَّ قُلُوبُهُمْ بِذِكْرِ اللَّهِ أَلَا بِذِكْرِ اللَّهِ تَطْمَئِنُّ الْقُلُوبُ. Those who believe and whose hearts are set at rest by the remembrance of Allah. Now surely by Allah's remembrance are the hearts set at rest. Verse 28 of chapter 13. So every human being actually tries to reach his Lord, and some may not do so because man has been created free. He has the volition, he has the free will to choose not to make efforts to reach his Lord. You know, it depends on the individual himself. Different people might want to do different things because at the end of the day, everyone is supposed to be answerable to his actions, to his deeds, and every individual is held responsible for his activities, for his deeds. Everyone is held responsible for his good deeds, for his bads, for his mistakes, for his making efforts to reach God. Some people might want to get closer to Allah, get nearness to Allah. Some may not do it, you know. Some might want to acquire infinite wealth in this world, which is so insecure and so transient, this world. The only way to fulfill oneself is by making one's soul aware of Allah. That's very important. We should try to reach him with full knowledge and be conscious of the goal we are trying to reach. O man, surely you strive to attain to your Lord, a hard striving until you meet him. The Quran says, يَا أَيَّهَا النَّاسِ إِنَّكَ كَادِحٌ إِلَىٰ رَبِّكَ كَدْحًا فَمُلَاقِيهِ. Brothers and sisters, there are different types of souls. The highest is the confidential soul, of course. In one of the previous episodes, we did talk about the different types of soul. But the highest, of course, is the nafs al-mutma'inna. Of course, the lowest one is nafs al-ammara. The nafs al-mutma'inna, or the confident soul, is the most perfect soul that obeys Allah to the extent that nothing can shake it. All the prophets and all the imams and the noble companions of the prophet, they were people with nafs mutmainna, you know. Like Imam Hussain alayhi salatu wasalam, whatever he was doing for the sake of Allah. So nafs mutmainna is not something for the imams only. Everyone can make efforts to achieve that perfection, to attain that level or that stage where his soul, where his nafs becomes, you know, confident. And of course, in order to attain this level, we must be in remembrance of Allah in each second of our life, our worldly life. Every expression of our life, our ideas, thoughts, deeds, looks, actions, and whatever we do should, you know, express Him rather than us. That is when we attain perfection. That's when we attain that degree or that stage of nafs mutmainna, that stage of the nafs, which is the stage of perfection. And, you know, to conclude, I would say that having a confident heart depends on the remembrance of Allah, the glorification of His attributes of beauty and perfection. And this is the secret key to our ascendance, to our perfection, and to the attainment of a station or the higher station or the ranks, you know. And it's necessary for every individual to try to ponder the attributes of Allah's perfection, His greatness, and man will never be satisfied by anything except by the remembrance of Allah. That's it for this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, He knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand, He knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash, He knows. Every thought I have and every word I share, He knows.
Like Trump, Boris Johnson has been especially effective in normalizing the scurrilous and norm-shifting aspects of radical right discourse, says Graham McPhee, author, in an article published under the heading "Neoliberalism is Normalizing Extreme Right Discourse in the UK." Stay tuned for more. One of the most familiar tactics of populist demagogues when under pressure is to shift the agenda away from reality and into a fantasy world of accusation, smears, false equivalences, and conspiracy theories. This erodes the boundary between the civil and uncivil, resulting in what scholar Ruth Wodak calls the shameless normalization of far-right discourse and ideas. As Wodak explains, the boundaries of the sayable are shifted, and traditional norms and rules of political culture, of negotiation and deliberation are violated by continuous provocations. Hoping to change the media conversation after a damning report on COVID rule-breaking within his administration, Conservative Prime Minister Boris Johnson swiftly deployed this tactic by smearing his chief parliamentary accuser, Labour Party leader Keir Starmer. The slur centers on the baseless and discredited claim that Starmer had protected from prosecution one of Britain's most notorious paedophile predators, this great celebrity Jimmy Savile. This untruth has its origins in the murky world of far-right conspiracy theory, and its endorsement by the Prime Minister has emboldened extremists. Most damning of all has been the condemnation by Savile's victims, relayed by lawyer Richard Scorer, who represented many of them. I can confirm that these allegations against Sir Keir Starmer are completely unfounded and unjustified, Scorer states unequivocally, adding that weaponizing the victim's suffering to get out of a political hole is disgraceful. Johnson's attempt to defend the false allegations suggests a level of a strategic purpose and political calculation, although he may have miscalculated this time. Polling remains dire, while support for Johnson among conservative legislators is ebbing as key aides resign. The jury is still out, and international events may yet give Johnson a reprieve. But if his premiership eventually crashes and burns, there is a danger that the problems this scandal reveals are personalized and localized. The contemptible nature of the smear and the Johnson's attention-grabbing personality encourage the tendency to see the rot only in this particularly bad apple, and the danger to democracy only in a certain style of political pantomime and a scurrilous discourse. Longer-term tendencies, social and institutional structures, and the cohorts of forerunners, allies, and enablers thereby go unnoticed. Recent political experience in the United States can be illuminating here. To an even greater extent, the oxygen-sucking presence of Donald Trump has focused attention on a single figure as the crux upon which the threat to U.S. democracy depends. But as a number of scholars have noted, the trends leading up to the present are deep-seated and still operative. And the coalitions invested in anti-democratic outcomes are more widespread than any single current or personality. In short, the anti-democratic slate is as much a function of the normal way things have been ticking over for decades as it is of moments of crisis, emergency, or the exceptional. In Britain, while Brexit certainly supercharged and antagonistic nativist politics that normalizes extreme right ideas, this tendency did not begin there. Xenophobic and authoritarian ideas that draw on and feed into the worldview of the radical right have been driving key government initiatives for decades. In 2012, the Conservative Liberal Democrat Coalition launched its hostile environment policy, a dizzying array of measures explicitly designed to make life so unbearable for undocumented migrants that they would voluntarily choose to leave. These policies culminated in the Windrush scandal, whereby an estimated 15,000 British citizens of Caribbean descent were wrongly classified as illegal immigrants, with devastating consequences. Families were separated, people lost their jobs and homes, and many were detained and threatened with being deported to countries they barely knew. The message being sent appears quite clear. Britain's problems are the result of alien invaders, and those invaders are most likely non-white. And in 2003, the then Labour government launched the Prevent Strategy, a post-9/11 initiative ostensibly aimed at preempting radicalization and preventing homegrown terrorism. Widely perceived as targeting British Muslims as a suspect community, the program has been criticized not only as counterproductive, but also for creating the potential for systematic human rights abuses and an increased risk of discrimination. And there is much more of a similar vein in the pipeline. Legislation currently going through Parliament includes a new borders and nationality bill that breaches international law and which arguably creates a second-class precarious version of citizenship for those with ties to other countries and unable to claim exclusively British descent. An elections bill on the GDP model imposes new and unnecessary obstacles to voting, which in the judgment of one of the governing party's own members of parliament, risks undermining one of the most fundamental rights we have here in the UK to vote freely without restriction. Meanwhile, the new policing and crime bill threatens to significantly erode the right to freedom of assembly and peaceful protest. In each case, the legislation is designed to pick apart the paradigm of universal democratic citizenship, which is meant to be open to all citizens regardless of race, ethnicity, social class, or political affiliation. Instead, they privilege a national population, the supposedly real English people, as opposed to ethnic outsiders and the cultural elites who are said to despise the nation. And it is this long-term build-up of a populist common-sense nativism that represents the most fundamental mainstreaming of extreme right norms and values. The dynamics driving this longer-term trend are complex, but a clue lies in the fact that its proponents include all the parties involved in government since the turn of the millennium. Labour and Liberal Democrat, as well as Conservative, for example, the origins of the hostile environment policy lie in the anti-immigrant crackdown under the new Labour administration in 2007. This speaks to the larger political shifts associated with the cementing of the neoliberal consensus since 1980s in Britain and globally. Neoliberalism, the ideology of privatization, financialization, and labor precarity, not only generates record levels of income and wealth inequality, but also leaves an ideological vacuum by jettisoning the element of redistribution once central to social democratic policies. As political philosopher Nancy Fraser has argued, the easiest way to compensate for this absence is to stress the elements of recognition in politics those culturally defined makers of esteem, status, and identity. And because extreme right ideas focus on the identity of majority of demographics through populist nationalism and resentment at perceived cultural disesteem, neoliberal politics finds a particular affinity there. According to Fraser, this affinity has been particularly strengthened in the UK and the US because under Tony Blair's New Labour and Bill Clinton's New Democrats, neoliberal economics was initially associated with a progressive model of recognition. The discourses of multiculturalism and gender equality that are now pilloried as politically correct or woke. Successful at the time, the center-left has bequeathed a legacy that for many seems to combine the worst of both worlds. While presiding over the collapse of secure employment, these administrations were perceived as sneering at the cultural norms and traditional values of the working class and the blue-collar middle class. For this reason, although governments of every stripe have implemented neoliberalism, it is the center-left that is perceived to have sided with the elites and betrayed ordinary people. After 9/11, New Labour in the UK jettisoned its commitment to multiculturalism and cultural cosmopolitanism, adopting a nativist rhetoric that even the Conservatives denounced as borrowing from the extreme right. But without a different model of economic distribution, a real shift away from neoliberalism, and a return to a revived social democracy, all that has been achieved is an even deeper normalization of extreme right discourse. And it is this tendency that subsequent conservative-led governments have pursued with relish. Like Trump, Boris Johnson has been especially effective in normalizing the scurrilous and norm-shifting aspects of radical right discourse. But the deeper threats to UK democracy, just as in the United States, will still need to be addressed once these divisive figures are gone.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytanir la'in ar-rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajhum. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at justice from the perspective of the commander of the faithful, Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salamullah. When we want to apply justice to humanity and to humans and to a society, we said one of the key elements to that is to have a leadership in place. A leadership that maintains and that secures the rights of the people, thus justice is established. The command of the faithful, Ali alayhi salam, he saw that khilafates, or rulership, or power, government, call it whatever you want, is the fact, it is the right of the people. And also he saw it that it is not permissible to compel a person to take the oath of allegiance, meaning election. You're free to elect or not to elect. Such compulsion can possibly be exercised in the public interest, but not in the interest of the ruler himself, which is a massive difference. When people decide not to elect, not to choose a person, it is because of their own interest, not for the interest of the ruler. So good relations can subside between the ruler and the subjects only when the people elect a ruler themselves
and take the oath of allegiance to him voluntarily, which is something that Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam did, and no one before him has did, and even the ones after him, they didn't either. One of the important factors that Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam applied in terms of trying to apply justice to society is that he freely associated and mixed with the people, with the subjects, because at the end of the day, they elected him to serve them, not for him to serve his own personal endeavors, not for his own personal interests, not for him to accumulate wealth, not for him to get power. That goes contrary and contradicts election and power in the first place. Not only did he apply that to himself, but he also made it the norm when it comes to his officials and to his governors. So this was a noticeable act in the government of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam in order to establish justice. He recommended that the officials emphatically to respect the rights of the people. So every time he appoints a governor, the number one law that Amir al-Mu'mineen sets is the fact that the rights of people need to be respected, need to be maintained, and need to be applied. And he introduced a tradition, a way of governing that has never been applied when it came to governors, something that we could relate to today, but we don't see it applied, something that we need today, but it's not applied, where Amir al-Mu'mineen applied it himself. Now, before we look into this tradition and this way of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam in establishing his own governors, let us take a short break and then we will continue.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity coming to you from IRIB English Radio. Just before the break, we were saying that Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, he introduced a new system, a new tradition, a way of living, you can say it, that when it comes to people and their governors, he made something very special, that every time he sends a governor to a city or to a place, doesn't matter whether it's small or big, he used to write a treaty that he hands to the governor. And that treaty contains and consists of a number of laws. And these laws are just to make sure that people and the governors get well together. So first, the ruler needs to make himself the public servant, that he works for the public, not vice versa. And the public, the subjects in return, they need to give their respect and obedience to that ruler who's trying to serve them. If this treaty is between the ruler and by the people, both parties accept, then all good and well. Amir al-Mu'mineen, he used to ask his commanders and he used to ask his governors that when they go to the city, first and foremost, they would gather the people and they would read the treaty to them. And they said to them, okay, I'm here to serve you, 1, 2, 3, 4. And if people accept to begin with, all good and well. If not, then Amir al-Mu'mineen would act differently and he would do something else. If any of the parties, later on decides to violate this treaty, the commander of the faithful, he himself, he would punish the party that violates this treaty. So, for example, in the case of the governor himself not applying the rules of Amir al-Mu'mineen and not going according to the treaty he signed with people, Amir al-Mu'mineen would first and foremost, he would take that person out of the position of government and he would replace him with someone else. And if he has taken wealth of the people, if he has mismanaged the people, if he has usurped and punished and was oppressive to people, Amir al-Mu'mineen would apply qisas to him. He would apply justice and retribution to that person. If people in return also violate the treaty, Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi would also speak to those people. So we can see that when Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi had appointed one of his governors to Basra, and that governor was doing what he was asked by Amir al-Mu'mineen. But when Talha and Zubayr and Aisha invaded Basra and they punished that governor and they tried to harm him and kill him, Amir al-Mu'mineen, he saw it as his duty to establish order once again, and he took his armies and marched towards Basra to make sure that this treaty that was violated is reinstated. And he done the same thing with Muawiyah as well. So this was the justice of the commander of the faithful that sadly we have not seen until today. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we followed Javad, an Iranian nature explorer and documentary filmmaker, to the south of Iran and saw the most amazing combination nature could match together, the desert and the sea. We also met the region's native inhabitants and got acquainted with their unique lifestyle. Stay with us as Javad travels to other villages of the region to discover the culture and customs of the people.
In the past, staple grains for all of Iran came from Sistan and Balochistan. But what for severe drought spells and misguided planning over the years, the province has completely lost that status. But today, in some areas of this province, and in the Bahu Kalat district in particular, all kinds of vegetables and tropical fruits are cultivated. There is a mango tree that's in full bloom, exploding with blossoms. In about 5 months, they will turn into delicious, juicy mangoes. This is heaven indeed. Walking around in the palm groves and other gardens in Bahu Kalad gives me a lot of peace. One of the most beautiful things I come across during my stroll is the Baluchi squirrel. The Baluchi squirrel, also known as the stripy or palm squirrel, is a unique species of rodents living in parts of Iran, Pakistan, India, Nepal, and Bangladesh. The most distinctive feature of this mammal is the dark stripes on a white background on its back. In the past, the inhabitants of Sistan and Baluchistan believed these stripes were the fingerprints of the gods. A typical Baluchi squirrel is between 13 and 15 centimeters from its head to the end of its rump, and its tail adds an additional 14 to 19 centimeters to its total length. It's quite refreshing to see Baluchi children playing and gallivanting around in the banana groves. Beautiful, pure souls, the product of their serene, peaceful surroundings. Children of Shir Gwaz spend the whole week waiting to go to the fruit groves near the village to expend some of their inexhaustible energy. What they also do is they cook their traditional food on their own, and just like their elders, they gather around, sing, and play. The kids here have distinctive, innocent faces. They are just gorgeous. And they're all wearing their traditional costumes, boys and girls alike, all wearing traditional clothes. They're among the oldest, most original tribes in Iran. They're very noble and very patient. They are a people with a lot of patience. And although some of them don't have good living conditions, they are very patient folks. They're so content. The Baluchi culture is the perfect example of a culture of nobility and peace, and those cultural traits are readily visible in the architecture of the old houses in this village. The architectural design is endemic to Baluchistan. You can't see anything like this anywhere else in Iran. There are also new houses in these areas with designs influenced by Indian and Pakistani cultures and architectures. One of the characteristics of Baluch families is their large populations. Wherever in the village I go, I'm surrounded by many of the little angels offering a breath of fresh air after a long day of hard work. They fill my heart with peace and joy. Perhaps one of the reasons these kids are so happy is their beautiful, tranquil, natural environments. Just as influential is the beautiful, happy colors used in the clothes that these little girls have on. Clothes that are embroidered by the artistic hands of their mothers. Hand embroidery on colorful clothes and fabric is among the most important crafts of Baluchi women. And fortunately, Baluchi women have been able to preserve this exquisite art, a skill handed down through generations. It's noontime. It can get really hot in Shir Gwaz, even in the middle of winter. But the boys of the village have a good solution to fighting the scorching heat. What they do at a time like this is jump into the waters of Shir Gwaz River and swim to their heart's content. These children usually play together in groups. The day offers an opportunity for me to make a return to the beautiful carefree days of my own childhood. Live life as an uninhibited, unabashed explorer of the unknown. Playing with these children serves as an outlet for the negative energy in me. Although the children in Shirguaz don't have much to entertain themselves with, they're all growing up happy, healthy, and strong by playing in groups and making the best of what their natural environment provides them with. No computers to spend the whole day on, playing virtual computer games that don't involve any physical activity, video games that have taken the place of playing outside for many kids today, outdoor experiences in nature, and plenty of physical activity that a growing body craves. These children's only toy is nature, going up trees, diving into the river and swimming, playing with animals, singing songs and helping their parents at home and on the farm, frolicking around and playing with stones and pebbles. This non-stop joyful mobility is the reason behind these children's physical health and happy disposition. Very soon, I leave the village and set out for my next destination. I have to travel 250 kilometers to the west of Balochistan, to a place 80 kilometers north of the city of Nikshar, a name that reminds me of my country's beautiful north. Given its unique geographical location, Balochistan has a diverse and strange climate. Some parts of this area is affected by the tropical climate of India, in the south by the Sea of Oman, in the west by the Jazmurian inland basin, and in the north by Lut Desert. Surrounded by these different climatic conditions, Balochistan features diverse lifestyles and various plant and animal species. Balochistan is a dry, water-thirsty land. The average annual rainfall in the province is around 110 millimeters. But the important thing is, all that water comes down in only a couple of torrential rainfalls that cause the rivers in the province to overflow their banks. The ensuing flooding leaves behind a trail of destruction every time. The people here tell me they get snow and blizzards in some winters too, because of the mountains in the Gorgan area. Perhaps you'll find it interesting to know there is a place named Gorgan in Sistan and Balochistan province. But no, it has nothing whatsoever to do with the city of Gorgan in the north of Iran. This area is comprised of around 11 villages punctuating this mountainous area. It can get freezing cold here. The people of Balochistan say, except for Mount Taftan and Mount Basman, the only other place where you can see snow in the highlands is the same Gorgan region in Balochistan. It can get really cold here. Because of the altitude and the relatively good rainfall here, this valley usually has a good amount of water. And abundant water means life and prosperity. The people of Gorgan are either farmers or orchard owners or livestock keepers. The most important thing for them to be able to do any of those things is to have clean drinking water. The people of the first village I visit are very kind and hospitable. In my conversations with them, I realize all the young people in the village are busy working simply because there is enough water. Everyone has something to do. They're all grateful to God for all their blessings. Their biggest asset is contentment. I could say most of the things I have seen in this village were built from scratch by the men and women living here. They are all content with what they have. They even have electricity. They live a beautiful, simple, and healthy life, away from the hustle and bustle of city life and excesses that distract human beings from their true self and from nature. The Baluch community leads a simple lifestyle in their simple homes in Baluchistan. They don't even expect a paved road. The peace that these lovely people exude is a breath of fresh air against the vicissitudes of city life. I am so at peace when I am in their fold. Before long, I resume my journey and arrive in the village of Archenik, a bucolic settlement second to none. But it isn't the architecture and natural environment that lends Archenik its beauty. The most beautiful thing I come across is the hospitality of the local inhabitants. Archenikis are hard-working, hospitable people. Moments after I reach the village, one of the elders comes to welcome me and invite me to his beautiful house, and the family gives me the red carpet treatment. Personally, I have a lot of respect for the culture and customs of this lovely ancient tribe and have tried my best not to have a negative impact on the culture or any of the good social norms of this community. Instead, I learned from them things that I had no idea about before I met them. I have had many trips to far and exotic places in Iran. And on those trips, I saw many and varied village houses and nomad tents. But nothing like the teeps in the Gorgan region. Beautiful, modest homes that offer peace and tranquility, just like their natural surroundings. Village elder Pir Muhammad fills me in on how they build their houses. My trip is nearing its end. That means I have to leave the beautiful Sistan and Baluchistan province and head back home. I leave with a bag of experience and memories as sweet as the dates of Gorgan, and I do so knowing that I haven't done any harm to the natural environment and the culture of this ancient tribe.
Well, I'm quite sure that this week's documentary about Iran's natural wonders intrigued all our audience across the globe, and I hope it inspires you to come and explore the hidden treasures of Iran. And that's it for this week. Do keep in touch with us, and until next week, goodbye. Thank you.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the importance of having halal sustenance. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the halal sustenance in the Islamic lifestyle. When we talk about the sustenance, generally there are two parts of sustenance. One is the apparent and the other is the spiritual. We will inshallah talk about the apparent sustenance, which is known as the food and drink. Therefore, when we look at the Islamic teachings, especially when we look at the Quran, in the Quran Allah says, فَلْيَنْظُرِ الْإِنسَانُ إِلَىٰ طَعَامِهِ, that a man or the mankind must look at what they eat. In today's world, we can see, especially in the UK, there were many programs which were made on the TV with the topic of you are what you eat. What does it say? It says basically that your actions, your deeds, your lifestyle shows what you eat. With your character, with your personality, someone can just imagine that what you eat. And those things that we eat, it have a direct effect on our body, on our nature, on our actions, on our habits. Therefore, when it is said that you are what you eat, it is totally right, because according to the Islamic teachings, this is said in the Quran as well, that Allah said that look at the food what you eat and do not eat anything which is in front of you and be careful while eating. Therefore, it is very, very important to pay attention to words, the things that we eat or drink. And if we can control our eating habit and drinking, then we can have a healthy life, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of the sustenance, and we said we're going to talk about the food and drink. And when it is said in the Islam, it is said that look at what you eat. It means that you need to look at all the aspects of this food which is in front of you. Where does it come from? And is it halal? Is it allowable? Or is it forbidden haram? Is it makruh? For example, it is better to leave it, or it is mustahab to eat it. It is better to eat it. And there are many other things. The source from which it has come, the money which I paid for this food, or the person who has provided this food in the market, who is he? What kind of food is it? Is it healthy, non-healthy? Is it according to the teachings and the preachings of Islam or not? Is it something which helps me in gaining the perfection in the path of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Or is it something that stops me? Is it according to the sunnah and the traditions of the Prophet? Or it is against those traditions? Therefore, it is very, very important that in the Islamic lifestyle, we must pay attention towards what we eat. And this is being said in Islam, and it was said before. Therefore, in today's world, if we see that a specific people or in a specific country, if they are discussing in today's world now, is that what you are, what you eat, it has been taken from the Quran. And we can see that the Quran and the Islam has told us about all these things from before. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Fires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Months of intense negotiations in the Austrian capital Vienna to revive the 2015 Iran